What is up, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome back to Fudge Muppet. I'm Scott here with Michael Drew. As always, this is the Elder Scrolls podcast, and today we are diving into the Skarl, the native tribe of Solstheim. Mm-hmm. Which one of you guys would like to introduce the Frosty Boys?
These Frosty Boys and Girls, the Skarl, are basically Nords, like racially speaking, who, instead of living in Skyrim and instead of following a very, mainstream Nordic kind of culture, they kind of have taken on their own culture, which is far more, I'd almost say indigenous in a sense, but they live, you know, alongside nature. They have all the kind of like kumbaya traits of like only take what you need from nature, only kill animals if you're going to eat it and use their fur, don't waste anything. You know, they're pacifist by nature. They're quite welcoming to outsiders in the sense that they, you know, they'll talk to you and be nice. They're not a hostile group of people. And they live a very traditional and religious life in a sense too. While it may not sound as interesting as some of the other pantheons from other cultures who've got all these different deities, the Skarl simply have the All-Maker, who is basically the maker of all things. And the flip side of that, though, there is another deity, if you will, called the Adversary, who represents basically all challenges of life and keeps the Skarl people strong. Another interesting thing just to note on the kind of introduction to the Skarl is that they are a very small group of people. You know, this is not some kind of big group with a lot of presence. They're very, like, on Solstheim. They're number fewer than 100, I believe. So they're kind of like an endangered species, if you will, themselves.
Yeah, it almost makes me curious. When it comes to their religion especially, you know, it seems so simplistic on the surface. But it makes me wonder, is it really just extremely simple, or do we not know nearly as much about them as we do about the other races? You know, like
we just don't know that much, because this is the thing, and the mist, it's one of these examples where the mystery is far cooler than what is likely the reality. But the Skarl, obviously, you know, you see Hermaeus Mora seeking it out. The Skarl have many secrets, and they have a lot of ancient traditions and like special knowledge that other groups on Tamriel simply don't have. You know, they have the ability to forge Stalrim. They have the ability to, I think it was like, listen to the winds and things like that that sound, you know, like you can personify the elements of nature and kind of like feed off them in an arcane way that other groups can't do.
I think that's the big like distinguishing factor, is that they're kind of probably a little bit of variation, but essentially like animists. And that being like animism in general is like believing that things, animals, trees, rocks, they all have a soul or some form of spiritual energy, that the world around them is very much alive rather than this sort of creation of gods that is rather this sort of static kind of thing. And you can sort of see that a little bit in how they also tend to skip all of the sort of personified deities like your Stendar and even the date, you know, there's limited degrees of it, but you know, Stendar and other nine divines and stuff like that, because really when you start looking at pantheons of gods and polytheistic religions, you sort of, they often like personify sort of, there'll be natural things and stuff they personify, but they become more so characters and starting personifying, or like personalities and themes and stuff, rather than literally being a rock. It's like the god of all the earth and so on, rather than no, this mountain is quite literally has a soul and a spirit to it, and there's sort of these qualities, and they all look back at, you can even look at the All-Maker, it's kind of looking at like either sort of, you know, shamanistic or all different kinds of religion, like, you know, I think it's actually from Greek mythology initially anyway, but you know, Gaia, the big concept of the Mother Earth, like that kind of vibe thing. It's the All-Maker seems very much like that. But in terms of their like actual history, you could probably make the argument that a lot of early Nords were potentially like that, because even if you look at the animal totems, like initially the Nordic pantheon are derived from these animal totems that they worshipped back on Atmora, and presumably they all came over from Atmora at some point, and then there was sort of a split, and they sort of isolated, and there was this sort of concept of the All-Maker and so on, that, and they stayed with their sort of totemic sort of religion as opposed to the pantheons of the Nords that sort of developed.
They also do have that very kind of reincarnation-based view of the world too. you know, that death is not to be feared, but not in any kind of courageous way, just in the sense that death is simply the start of something new. And it's funny because in many ways, a lot of the Skull kind of belief system does align with, I guess, what we in the Elder Scrolls community can see as the, you know, quote, truth about the universe, you know, like talking about things like the Dream Sleeve, talking about things like Cowpers and stuff like that. They seem very, the Skull seem very in tune with kind of the cyclical nature of the universe.
Well, it's also funny, you know, with them being Nords, how much it actually does align with Nordic beliefs, just kind of with different dressings on it. You know, for example, you've got, you know, not fearing death, like a warrior with, if they've got the choice between death and exile, they would take death, like an honorable death, you know. And you've got the Kenlorn wolves that are summoned in order to like eat, you know, criminals or whatever. And they kind of, the Skull would embrace that tradition rather than surviving but being shunned. And it kind of brings into question who the Allmaker and the Adversary are, because it's quite easy to see the Allmaker as like, oh, if this is the complete embodiment of everything, would you say it's like they're the closest to seeing the Godhead? Or potentially there's a lot of evidence to suggest that maybe the Allmaker is just their perception of Shaw or Lorcan, and the Adversary is their perception of Auriel.
I was just going, yeah, it's funny that, because typically, and even you can look at the wikis and stuff, they sort of cite it as like Anu, Padme, as in Allmaker, Adversary. But if you actually, you know, like you're saying, look at the Adversary. It's interesting that Herman Mora is sometimes associated with that, but Tha'tag, aka Alduin, the World Devourer, is seen as an aspect of the Adversary. But as we know, like Alduin, Akatosh, all of Auriel, it's all associated, it's very much derivative of sort of like Anu and Anuiel and stuff like that. So the actual Anuic force here is seen as an aspect of an Adversary. However, I don't know where Herman, I can't remember if Herman Mora is said as an aspect of, or is he just another sort of tricky,
he's just a demon person. Spirit, I believe.
So yeah, I guess if we were going to say that the Allmaker and the Adversary were kind of depictions of Anu and Padme, I would be inclined to say that the Allmaker is more Padme than Anu, because, you know, they credit the Allmaker with kind of creating all the elements and creating the world that they live in. You know, they've got the kind of the six, you know, let me find the specific six that they believe in, if I can actually find it now. But you've got your flora, your fauna, your earth, and I can't remember what the other three are.
Sun, beast, like the stones and stuff.
So essentially everything that makes up the realm that they understand, the mortal world. And Padme is kind of the limitation on Anu that allows this to be created. And obviously, you know, you've got Lorcan comes from Padme. Lorcan is the creator of the mortal realm. So it makes sense that that is their idea of the Allmaker.
I tend to buy into that, because there's one other thing to consider there, is that the Adversary is also, like one of the other aspects, he's also called the Greedy Man. But if you think of that in the frame of Anu wanting to be everything and unlimited and so on, but if you actually look at that like infinity as almost a sense of greed, like I want everything and so on, and he's so opposed to any limitation imposed on him by Padme or Lorcan and so on, like the Allmaker, it's an interesting dynamic, because I feel like people just go, oh, goody, so Anu, Allmaker, they must be aligned. But I think there's a really good case to make that it is actually the reverse.
And if you've got the idea that when the Skull die, they return to the Allmaker and then they'll eventually be reincarnated, it kind of sounds a lot like, you know, just another way of saying that Nordic warriors go to Sovngarde, which is the domain of Shaw, to then come back to the mortal realm afterwards. It's like the parallels are there, even if we get a very simplified version of their religion, because when you hear the Allmaker, just, oh, okay, they've just got a basic ass, like, oh, there's just one god who's responsible for everything. But once you look a bit deeper, you can see how it would spread out from the initial Nordic belief system.
I mean, even their origins, you know, they believe that they were kind of breathed onto Solstheim by the Allmaker, and the Nords believe they were breathed onto the throat of the world. You know, not straying too far from the topic of the Adversary, it is interesting that in the story of Eivor Stonesinger, there's this part where he goes to steal like the seeds back from this evil Falmer who's taken them and is basically hiding them among some evil tree spirits. And it says, they told him that the seeds had been stolen by one of the Falmer, in brackets, for they are the servants of the Adversary. and this Falmor was hiding them deep in the forest so that none would ever find them. How could that play into this?
Well, yeah, the snow elves, you know, worshipping Auriel, servants of the adversary, and so on. And it sounds very strange. Like, even if you think about, like, kind of how the religion would develop, you've got all of the Nords come over with their totemic sort of religion. The dragon cult gains the main favor. The Skarl even think and said that they're descended from the dragon cult originally on Solstheim. So them, they've just had sort of like an isolated split off where it goes more into this Allmaker stuff. And then the dragon cult kind of got defeated across the board. And then the rest of the totemic religions in the Nordic faith and Skyrim just sort of became like their Stun and Shore and such. But still, like, in all of those religions, you've always got the sort of Anuic aspect as the adversarial one, whether it's the adversary or Thartag, or whether it is, you know, Alduin, the World Eater for the Nords and so on. That's always, it's kind of, you know, it makes sense. Like, it's like, where would the pro-Anuic sort of thing come from if Allmaker was Anu? But it's not. Oh, that's what I'd say. I would say it's not. I would say it's Padme is the Allmaker for sure. Yeah. I think in that dynamic, because, like, once again, everything's just sort of like, even, you know, Anu and Padme is a, you're all working within cultural distinctions. So that's what the elves call the separation or so on.
But so, like, so you think that the greedy man then is Anu,
yeah,
who comes though to, but the purpose of the greedy man was to show the Skarl people not to be greedy. Basically, the story of the greedy man involves him kind of coming there.
Tempting,
I think the story says, basically takes away all their stuff. Yeah. And there's this whole quest to, you know, that's the story of Eivar Stonesinger, is that the greedy man basically takes all the things that they love. You know, he kind of like takes the wind and takes the sun and all this.
Yeah, but
and
it's
basically,
it says they forgot or chose not to remember that the adversary is always watching, and that he delights in tormenting the Allmaker and his chosen people. And so it was the adversary that came to be among the Skarl. It was the adversary that kind of, he's the malevolent figure. It's not like, I'm going to test you. It's like, he likes the torment and so on, that the Allmaker says, stay to the true ways kind of thing, and like live among nature and stuff. So it doesn't, you know, it's basically like Allmaker too. Like, everything they do is, it's all acceptance of mortality. Like, it's reverence of the world you live in, reverence of the natural cycles, reverence of everything.
I suppose my point is more like that the greedy man played a useful role in kind of like Skarl religion. Like, their whole story is that he took away these things.
But that doesn't mean he intended to.
Well, the elder warrior,
like, you can have anti-role models, or like negative people can, you know, or negative things or beings or whatever can give you like lessons that are valuable.
The contrast,
but it doesn't mean that they were in your best interest.
No, sorry. I'm not trying to say that the greedy man was acting in their best interests. I'm more saying that the story of the greedy man is interestingly set up as a kind of, you know, an interplay between these two forces, which, yes, ultimately the Allmaker helps Eivar and guides him to go and get the Allmaker's things back. But the lesson at the end, which is in favor of the Allmaker, is don't forget my ways, because if you do, you know, this will happen again. It kind of won't happen in your lifetime, but the greedy man may come back, or will come back, when there's another era and the Skarl have become complacent, and, you know, you'll have to learn the lessons of not to disrespect the Allmaker again. It's just interesting. Yeah. It's kind of like symbiotic, I guess, is a better word. Not necessarily, like, on purpose, though.
Mm. Yeah. Sorry, meaning that the adversary is...
Well, in the same way that the Dunmer can have testing gods who they may despise, and, you know, Malakath or Molag Bal as a testing god may, you know, kind of just do things because he's Molag Bal and he wants to cause suffering and torment. But at the end of the day, it still kind of can help the Dark Elf people, or it's seen like that. In the same way, the greedy man makes sure, whether it's intentional or not, like, it's likely not intentional or not in their best interests, but the reality is that the Skarl end up better off for it.
Yeah, in every religion, you need the opposing forces to kind of balance one another out, extremely simply put. But, you know, otherwise you'd just get complacent and not be so interested in listening to your benevolent gods if there's not something to be fighting against. And that's kind of, so it's like, when you really boil it down, that's kind of just their simplistic way of viewing what basically every religion in the Elder Scrolls has anyway, just in a more complex form.
Yeah. Yeah, so ultimately I do think that the All-Maker being Padme is far more compelling than Anu being the adversary, rather than, you know, get out of your elven mindset where you assume if it's good sounding, it must be Anu or Auriel or Akatosh or whatever, you know. But also one thing to worth mention too is, like, while it's very easy to paint the picture of the skull being all, like, you know, like they're fully part of nature, but it's not all hippies in the way that they are quite tough in their adherence to ways. Like, I think it's in, especially in the Blood Moon DLC in Morrowind. So this is, you know, and towards the end of the third era, they are far more, you even see them, they've got like armor. They look far more intimidating and so on, and seem more harsh than the far more like, let's sit around a campfire kind of ones you see in the Dragonborn DLC. Mm-hmm. But like Drew was mentioning before, like a sacrifice, I forgot exactly what it was, but it was a guy that steals or something like that. And this is seen as something incredibly serious in Skull society, because there's not a lot to go around and so on. So he had two options. It was basically exile or death by these wolves, or being eaten by the wolves. And you can almost see that as, like, you know, you're put to use in nature or something like that, like them like eating your corpse. But the actual death by sacrifice is seen as the more you know, a desirable one, and it's actually it's like a dishonor almost to be exiled and so on, by comparison to you know, you could die with some honor being ritually sacrificed.
It's worth noting again just quickly that these wolves too were summoned. Like, yeah. It's just another example of how the Skull seem to be very in touch with a natural and mysterious magic that isn't well understood. It's kind of more like that soft magic of it just is what it is. Like, wave the wand and here are the wolves. Where did they come from? Who knows? But they're here. They came from some sort of spirit plane. Like,
and I mean, to add to that whole idea of the sacrifice and... when you view the Skull as like it's all about not having anything in excess. So you can understand why a thief would be considered perhaps like the greatest offender of all criminals, because, you know, like, for example, with a tree, they won't chop down a tree. They'll only use wood, which is an essential tool. They'll only use it if it's already fallen down. So you can imagine that in this world, like, yeah, they're willing to do, you know, they'll do what it takes to survive, but that's kind of where they draw the line. It's like, if we're surviving and prospering, you know, you don't need excess, basically. So if you're willing to steal, then you're doing the exact thing that your entire culture goes against your entire culture.
Especially with their greedy man kind of stories, you are being the greedy man. Mm-hmm. You know, you're stealing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You are showing yourself as the embodiment of the adversary, or one of his aspects, perhaps.
Yeah.
So you need to be sacrificed.
And but yeah, it's probably also worth mentioning too, like you were mentioning the different elements and stuff before, that there is all these different stones and so on, and in general that the Skull are incredibly tied to the land. And there's this basically a story of a character called Eivar Stonesinger, who originally he was a young boy of the sort of the Skull and so on, and this is the same story where the greedy man, because they got all lax. All the Skull got lax and, like, you know, lethargic and stopped adhering to the practices of the All-Maker. The greedy man came and took away, like, the, you know, the forests and the oceans and everything and so on. So what happened was, this young boy goes around to all of the different stones and does these sort of like challenges or something, like, you know, to restore the oceans. Mm-hmm. He had to go and like find this like Black Hawker thing. And there's all these different interactions. Like, one of them, like Michael mentioned before, was the whole getting the seed or whatever it was from the Falmer to restore the forest.
The water one, he goes down, follows a Black Hawker until he kind of goes super deep into a cave, pops up into an air pocket and retrieves the waters that were stolen, and with all his might brings them back.
And there's several of those kinds of things. And basically, the Stone Singer, Eivar, goes around and restoring all of these totemic sort of stones and restoring the elements and restoring the balance of the world and restoring the ways of the All-Maker and so on. But that kind of thing, you do a similar thing in the Blood Moon DLC. And of course, you also do a similar thing purging those same stones from Mirak's influence in the Dragonborn DLC. So you're sort of playing the same kind of role a few different times.
It's interesting too to hear in the story that why the Skull wouldn't go. It's like the elder saying, I can't, I have to lead the Skull and tell our people what is lore. And the warrior, I can't go, I have to protect the Skull, I need my sword in case the greedy man reappears. And the shaman can't go because the people need my wisdom, you know, I have to offer my knowledge. So they've got all these copes, basically. Which is a good representation of how they've become lazy and complacent. And Eivar it's worth noting, is kind of a nobody. Like, they actually laugh at him when he says that he will go and do it. But his logic is basically like, I'm a no one here. I won't be missed if I fail. And so he's kind of that heroic underdog that nobody expects to succeed, who, you know, the Allmaker takes kindly to. I do get the vibe almost like he was destined to succeed. Like, when you read this story, it has this vibe of, like, he can't fail. But if he kind of has to show ultimate sacrifice and ultimate courage, and then it's almost as if the Allmaker will make it that he succeeds. Like, you read that story and tell me he dies on one of those challenges. That's not, it's not, it's not based. It's just, it just wouldn't work.
And I mean, it's like the typical example of the pilgrimage, you know. It's like, in any religion, if you go on your pilgrimage, it's kind of like, it's your cue to appreciate the world, to question your spirituality, your faith, and to reinforce it in the end. So if you've got this group of people who worship the land and what the Allmaker provides them, but they're too lazy to go on the pilgrimage around their island to appreciate it and to reinforce their beliefs, then you can see how they've failed.
Perhaps this is a little bit too tangential for the whole conversation, but it is about just religion stuff in general, talking about pilgrimages and stuff like that. But it is interesting to look at how many of religious cultural practices and stuff like that are kind of mimicking, and in a way you could kind of say mantling, a previous sort of thing. So for example, like, you know, following the same pilgrimages of certain prophets or something like that, or visiting the same sites, or certain like little rituals are actually parts of a story that have been redone. So in this example, you know, if you're doing the same, you know, pilgrimages around the stone as Eivor Stonesinger, you're taking a cultural hero and you're doing the same act in a kind of way. But it's interesting when you actually think about like humans, like being so compelled to repeat stories and sort of like arcs and fulfill roles and stuff in these sort of narratives that get played over and over and over again in history. And then they sort of form like strings of these sort of mythological kind of things. Like, this is what Elder Scrolls really tries to do. And you see it so many, you can get onto the whole like enantiomorph sort of concepts, or these sort of combinations of different, you know, rebel, witness, king, and these kinds of archetypes. But these archetypes you do see multiple times throughout the history, through the gods, through all like the mythic tales. And it's kind of like, if you kind of view it as like a sort of a stage really, or a drama or something, and how people fit into these roles, and then they sort of fulfill these things, like, you know, even prophecies and so on like that are all really stories told before they happen. So it's kind of like viewing everything in the Elder Scrolls is far more helpful if you view everything as story, or everything as, I mean, it is fiction to us, but I mean, if you start viewing everything in the world as fiction and like quite literally story and story arcs and so on, it helps you understand the cultures and stuff. So you could use that for the skull, but you could use it more broadly too.
Yeah,
very,
I mean,
very
like,
deep, you know, insight.
I mean, even just the name of kind of like the fundamental source for learning about the gods in the Elder Scrolls being called the monomyth. And it kind of like, when you think about the monomyth in real life, you think about the hero's journey, the cycle of kind of like the, you know, the call to action, the challenge, and overcoming the obstacle and returning better for it. You know, you're going on a journey, you're going on a pilgrimage. So it all kind of ties into the story aspect for sure. And yeah, and the skull may seem like they're very basic religion, but just like all the others, it kind of uses these recurring themes.
Yeah,
I think it's funny. It's like what they use as a criticism, and I would say unfairly so, that gets of just sort of any animistic kind of religions in general, is that it has a sort of childlike quality to it, because like a kid will sort of think that their toys or something has feelings, or all of these things. Oh, I don't want to hurt the tree because it has feelings, but like, you know, and you know, you can go like, oh, science, we don't understand, they don't have feelings and stuff like that. But that I feel like is probably it's how a lot of early religion probably started, or a lot of like believing that there is a soul to nature, and that nature is more personified. And then later, as you know, the culture becomes more advanced, you know, or advanced or whatever, everything becomes more abstracted and removed from nature, and it's about like, you know, gods of civilization. So then you have gods of commerce, which is, for example, a completely, you know, it's a figment or of society, a complete like structure. It doesn't exist within the natural world. It's just it's a concept. Do you know what I mean? Or
it's kind of like Xenathar is an interesting divine in that sense, because what is he really all about? Even agriculture was not like, you know, originally around. You know, if you talk about like a day of hard work and toil and all this kind of stuff, it almost makes him feel like a more modern god, or like a god that was kind of pulled from, like, you know, the Bosma have Zen and things like this. You can see how the different aspects can get changed over time.
It's like the more advanced a society becomes, so that, you know, the more advanced the human race becomes, the more disconnected they get from the world that they exist in, and the more human centric their belief system becomes. So, you know, gods of nature are replaced by gods of what is relevant to our culture, like commerce, you know, which wouldn't really make sense fundamentally at the beginning, you know.
Yeah, Zenithar is considered the more sophisticated god. There's a specific word they use for it. The more refined of the two. But even Zen is still a Bosmeri god of toil, vengeance, agriculture, and payment in kind.
Yeah.
But, you know, but what, like, what was before Zen? What was Zen based off? I want to get something a bit more animalistic.
But it's like when you have like all of the gods and you view them as sort of like, you could probably like go and look at all of the pantheons all across or Elder Scrolls, and if you were thinking like, oh, what exists in nature, you could probably like eliminate like 90% of them. And you can also see that, like, you know, gods sort of, you know, there's this whole, like, you know, the concept of myth makes reality or whatnot, or the way gods worshipped perhaps like influences or changes them, or maybe it is just different cultural ideas about them. But you can see, and this is even in our real world, that the views of gods adapt with the culture, because it almost feels like, to be honest, like a lot of gods anyway are personifications of a culture or like some sort of broad kind of like, or cultural ideals and so on, and that's how it kind of shifts. And in older places, like, you know, you could look at things like the you know, how Ares was once a very popular god of war, but then later on, like, that started becoming Athena's kind of thing was far more valued or so on. But it was sort of like how gods in different parts of history have different things attributed to them because they adapt with the culture and the stories and whatever is valued more highly. You know,
The Daedric princes and other the Aedra as well, but they're all based around simple concepts that would exist in a very natural world regardless. You know, like Shea Gorath, your favorite Daedra, is, you know, based on the idea of, you know, being mentally insane. You know, being a madman, which, you know, anyone could be a madman, or the idea of
natural. He becomes the Daedric Prince of mad cow disease. Like, but
madness can exist in other forms. You know, like, I mean, all the different Daedric princes, like, I don't know, just pick one. They're all based on different natural things. Yeah. Like even Hermaeus Mora, secrets. It's not a human, like, secrets.
But I think secrets, you need language and communication. And if you remove the human element,
humans are natural, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Look at something like Shaw, you know, you look at like Lorcan, it's like, oh, just the god of mortality, of mortals, these beings walking around and kind of almost like the Allmaker in a way, but people, obviously there's more nuance to it, but it's like, oh, just the god of the mortal realm of everything and of men. Yeah. Like, it's not sophisticated thing like with Zenithar when it's commerce or trade or like something that's very...
But a lot of them do still built up do on, get like, or like for like Mephala's entire sphere, I would even say, like, Boethius and stuff.
Lies.
Oh, but it's Mephala's use of sex is not in just... It's like a society. It's a use as a tool. It's like comparing
it to the murder.
It's not just procreation in general. The function of it.
I guess my point is, at the very base level, all of these things are just derived. You know, they can advance and be built on over time, but they're all just derived from very like natural inclinations or desires or things. Like, even the Daedra themselves are very like human. You know, at their very nature, they're quite individual. Like Azura, for example, wanting attention and to be admired. And, you know, she's almost insecure despite being this big, powerful spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, all the spirits coming into being for the purpose of self-reflection, you know, both Aedra and Daedra, you know, the idea of the initial story of its Anu wishing to ponder itself beyond its perfect brightness, you know, relies on having the obstacle to then, you know, it's, yeah, so it's all self-reflection. So that's why I think, you know, Daedra and Aedra tend to be quite flawed when you actually see how they function.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the list of Daedric princes, like Sanguine, that's a very like carnal pleasure-based thing. You know, like Periite, diseases, natural order, nocturnal, nighttime, Namira, like darkness and decay. Like these are all things that aren't built upon a big tower of human-based concepts.
But I'd still say like two-thirds of it is. Like even Namira, so like decay is fine, but like the whole idea of mortal revulsion, disgust and all this kind of stuff. Like a lot of those things are
disgust
just perspective
is a
of
natural,
what nature.
Yeah, but they're natural instincts. I think it even says that something that instinctively makes mortals feel revulsion, right? My point is not to say that they're not advanced and that they're all like the Allmaker. My point is just to say that they can be, in a way, viewed as a lot more base, is in like base human nature related, than things like Xenathar. Or like Julianos, a very like scholarly based kind of bookworm.
Well, see, that's kind of what it like. Yeah, well, like here's a good example of Julianos, is how he's the bookworm and academic kind of things have been later attributed to him, which initially was just something as simple as like wisdom and hermetic orders as Junal,
for
and
sure.
hermetic
for sure.
orders are bound around like, you know, introspection and esoteric sort of knowledge and stuff like that. It's a you could that's an example of a progression from or from an owl,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
a very some kind of owl figure or whatever, but like. Yeah. yeah.
I mean, one thing that's complete like 180 from this topic, but like it's interesting to think what the relevance of Stahlrim is to the skull, because they consider it to be a very like a kind of sacred material, but then mostly I feel like their association with it is mostly just purely the fact it's on Solstheim, right? Because essentially the way this material works is that during the wars with the Khymer, the Nordic dead were buried on Solstheim, which their clever men, their mages, protected from necromancers and grave robbers by essentially enchanting the ice that surrounded them. So what do you make of the Skarl viewing this as a very precious, sacred resource?
Well, just to quickly note that the ice enchantment that Stahlrim has was said to be drawn from the land itself, which makes it sound a bit different to me than the kind of like, I'm enchanting this with a soul gem or by pulling magical forces from Aetherius or something like that. Like it feels very much like ground up from the land.
Right. So do you think that the like Skarl mages could have been heavily involved in the magic to do with this? Or do you think it's just in general
it
the
could
Nords
be like,
being...
Well, I just I remember like where like the Skarl come, like chronologically where they come from. They would have just been a bunch of Nords on Solstheim worshipping the Dragon Cult stuff, and then there's all the Valok, the Jailer stuff, and fighting Mirak and so on. And then there's sort of the offshoot of tribes from there. So the Stahlrim like burial practice would have already been, I guess, like established and so on. And it's hard to tell exactly when the Skarl offshoot, like, because they're only a small tribe too, or only have been. It's not like there's some huge part of the population. And they did get isolated by supposedly the big battle between Mirak and Valok, the Jailer, which severed the island of Solstheim from it, which therefore easily makes it an isolate, so it can just sort of grow culturally distinct by itself because it's not connected. But
what do you think about that story? It's hard to know what the deal is there. It almost sounds like just a nice little fable to explain why they're separated.
There is interesting. I don't know if it's also just mythology, but there's that they're separated. I think it's cool. Like it could be a cool mythology thing, or it could be even literal as it's cool. But the I think in the Eivar Stonesinger story, it says that Solstheim was like a warmer time or something like that, but basically a much nicer climate. And I know that Kodlak Whitemane also says things like, oh, distant green summers or something like that in their chances. There's lots of allusions in a bunch of Nordic things to these like this old time when things were good and green and stuff like that. And it's interesting to think what it could have been like that. But like if you did have some old, maybe Skyrim and Solstheim wasn't as cold, but I'm trying to think. No, that would make it worse.
I mean, they had the sun, which gave them warmth, but I don't think it ever said Solstheim was warm.
Because if you, here's a really, really like boring, like make it logical answer kind of thing. But you know, in the same way that you had if you have like glacial freezing and stuff like that, and freezing up the water and so on, but then it makes the water levels. Hold on, or I got it the wrong way around. It should go up. Well, because what was it when?
This ain't a science podcast.
This ain't. No, that would make, yeah. So, but that would make it colder in the past. Because what I'm saying is, like, you know, if there was lots of like Arctic freezing, like Atmoran freezing and stuff like that, there would be less water just sort of flowing out, so that then you would have like more land. So if there was a land bridge between Solstheim, but then it would have to be on the idea that it melts and then their sea levels rise and then that land gets covered up. It's not a good answer.
This is one of those scenarios where we put more thought into it than whoever created the
Look, at the end of the day, yeah, it's magic, bro. But I was just trying to, you know, I think the magic's the best answer. I kind of like it. I don't see why I can't have a cool big super battle that like crushes the land. Mm, yeah. I mean, other things have done it around the place. And
I think it's also worth noting too that when you play Skyrim, because a lot of people haven't played Morrowind, but when you go to Solstheim, like, they are affected by the eruption of Red Mountain too. So it is a different environment. There's a lot more, like, you know, ash, and they are struggling to, you know, have food sources more than they have before. Because
hunting netches.
Well, many things have been, like, kind of like crops destroyed, or plant matter and vegetation and different things aren't as plentiful, which then means animals aren't as plentiful. And you get the picture.
Yeah. As for Stalrim, I guess, like, at one point they were opposed to using it, and then they were again into the smithing of it again. Like, they've gone through ebbs and flows about like whether it should or should not be used, but
because it almost seems like, you know, like in my head canon, when I'm thinking about the origins of Stalrim and how it, you know, maintains its power, it's almost like the ice is powered by the kind of the animus, the soul energy of the bodies that were buried in these tombs. It's almost like that's the soul gem source of the magic that remains in the Stalrim.
What is it, like a self-sustaining soul gem, but like this massive blue thing that you're trapped in? It's like a very cheap cryogenic experiment.
This is probably a more boring explanation, but I always thought it had something to do with the Thorm, like sort of ice form. Like, I mean, they're all of these shout people that can do magical things with their breath and stuff like that. You can imagine them sort of breathing onto this sort of pour a bucket of water them and then breathe it on and freeze them into the thing or something like that. But because it happened for a lot of them, I think it was because they were talking in the story of the Snow Prince, you know, all were buried in Stalrim. He was buried like ceremonially, but not with Stalrim, because that was reserved only for, you know, Nords.
The idea that Nords would bury their dead in ice seems like a cool idea that could have been explored more. Because like when you kind of get into that theory that water is memory in the Elder Scrolls, you can imagine ice being like the preservation of their memory and all of their memories in that that ice that you could then channel in the future if you know, or it would be too sacred to use, but you know what I mean, like
a spiritual epitaph kind of thing. Like, it's like you just direct tune into the ice around them. I remember suggesting that for the ideal Skyrim video, like in that in Windhelm, they should have had, like, you know, Stalrim burials and stuff like that. There's so many. It's a problem that's with the trend of Elder Scrolls in general. It's they really shy, like they like to just jump all of the cool, you know, more abstract stuff and put it back in history, and then like they all the modern stuff is some sort of watered down,
or just make it fringe, which like in a way does add value to the Skarl as a faction. You know, it's more interesting that the Skarl can do that. It's just another secret that they have. But I could probably agree that it would be cooler if, like you said, in Windhelm, it's just a thing that the Nords can do, and then make the Skarl more interesting by exploring, you know, their other secrets they're said to have many of, that Hermaeus Mora has always been hunting after, and who, if you... It's kind of a raw trade, isn't it? Like, you just get this Skarl guy killed who has this knowledge that Mora wants in the Dragonborn DLC, just so you can get the third word of the Bend Will shout, that you need to defeat Mirak, even though he's immune to Bend Will. Isn't it just so you can ride the dragon?
Yeah.
Is it Sarloknir? I forget the name. Anyway. That you go and ride and then fight him up there.
Yeah.
Poor Skarl.
I overall, I think Nords should have Nordmaxed, and when we get to Redguards and Hammerfell, they should definitely Redguard Max and pull in all of the crazier parts of the lore and try and make it as prevalent as possible, rather than, you know, boring maxing, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Have you seen the Starrim armor and weapons in Elder Scrolls Online?
Actually, I'm not.
Oh,
I have now. I probably have before.
I don't know if that's necessary. It's called Frostcaster style, and they have Starrim weapons, and then they just have this kind of like furry, almost male looking arm, like chainmail with fur bits, and then like bits of ice Starrim. They almost look like ice wraith teeth, just like sticking off.
Yeah, or almost like slightly Daedric inspired kind of spikes. Yeah. But then they, you know, you can see like little chips of it in the chest, which kind of does allude to. I can't remember what it was, but isn't there a story of like a smith using chips of Starrim in bone mold armor to make it stronger?
I think that's what happens for the improved bone mold in the game Dragonborn. You're learning the recipe.
Yeah, okay. Because that's kind of what it looks like in the ESO one, is that they're just using chips of Starrim to kind of enhance the armor. But let's be honest, it's mostly just because it looks cool. But
yeah.
It definitely doesn't look as good as... Morrowind's and Skyrim's Starrim. I think Morrowind's being the best. I think we concluded that when we were talking about the armors, right? When we were comparing Starrim between Skyrim and Morrowind. It's like Morrowind's looks a bit blockier, but that kind of makes sense if you're forging out of ice.
Man, check out the... Sorry.
No, go on.
I was going to say, check out the Starrim Frostcaster style on USP, and you go down the bottom where they're displaying all the Starrim weapons, and they're just using a butt-naked Khajiit. Just like full on, it's just an interesting photo shoot they've done there for their resources. I would have worn armor if it was me, but you know.
That looking at it more, that is very boring armor. If you take off those tiny little chips of Starrim, it's just
very regular,
very basic furs essentially. But yeah, there you go.
But yeah, I think that's majority of like, just on the scale outside of like just naming characters and things they do. I mean, actually, another thing that's worthwhile, which I like, is that originally the Draugr was said to have been cursed by the Allmaker for practicing cannibalism and so on, and that's why they live on in undeath in this like, you know, vile sort of way. And that's basically from Blood Moon lore, but obviously the dragon cult stuff got all added and stuff like that. So
I think
they're not anymore. I think that's just lore that's gone.
I think we can't finish this podcast as much as you want to without talking about Thirsk, which is the mead hall on Solstheim, which was basically founded by a group of Skarl who kind of did, you know, an Uno reverse card and said, we want to be more like the Nords again. You know, we don't want to be this, natural, very like kumbaya tribe. We want to actually go and do whatever we want, basically, and fight valiantly and kill things if we want to, worship whatever we want to worship. And it's kind of a bit of a might makes right society, in the sense that whoever could put the greatest trophy or sign of achievement upon like this pedestal would be the chieftain of the hall. And there were many different chieftains over the years who, you know, some were leading out of acts of fraud, other ones were leading out of, you know, heroic acts. But funnily enough, the first one, Hrothmun the Red, when you actually read the story, he has this huge axe that he supposedly wielded in battle. But when you read the actual story about it, it kind of just says, like, his leadership was challenged, so he drew his axe and just chopped off the guy's head. Like, it didn't feel like the most, like, fair battle. I guess that's what it was like back in the day, but it was just like, oh, clearly I'm the better warrior because you standing there challenge. I just whipped out my axe and chopped your head off and you're dead and I'm alive. So, you know, how about that?
Yeah, well, who's going to challenge that? It's like the next guy comes up. It's like, actually, I've got a problem with that. And then his head goes off.
It's really cool in Morrowind when you first go to the Thirsk Mead Hall thing, because it's basically just a Beowulf story transposed into this. The whole, like, the Utafrakt attacked and the hall's all in damage and so on. And when you do find the Utafrakt or Utafrikt or whatever you want to call it.
The troll spirit.
The troll thing. And it has like a severed human arm as like its like weapon that it's like throwing. But it's like, it's cool because it's basically just riffing off Beowulf and Grendel, like attacking the hall and then going, and then you go off as like Beowulf to defeat Grendel.
Some of the leaders you've had have some, there's Gisel Roundgut, who was slain by Einar the Younger, and he presented his stomach as a battle trophy, you know, because his belly was so big. He was just like, you know, here's the belly. There was all kinds of interesting things. Interestingly, there was a Breton leader at one point as well. But when you read about the rulership, because it goes on for quite a long time, you know, there's leaders that were leaders for 2 months or 3 weeks, but then there's ones that led for like 16 years, you know? It's funny, the little lore kind of things that they... So like there's Thorum Stormkiller, Nordmail, slew the brothers Annie and Ali and presented their enchanted hammers as battle trophies, ruled over Thirsk for 16 years. You know, there's all slew the imperial hero this, slew the imperial fraud that.
It's kind of funny how a location that separated from others because it's all about might makes right, and then when you go and see it in Skyrim, it's ruled over by the Reeklings. They've happened to get control of it now. So I guess this whole, like, the strongest rule kind of fell apart towards the end.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it really was just kind of like a bunch of ragtag bandits who were just, you know, like one big happy barbarian family, but often would kill each other over disputes and wanting to be, you know, just battling for leadership positions, almost like an orc stronghold of Nords with less rules and
more mead.
I guess there's only one other thing I can think of or something that I think the Fry's Hags or something they're called. They're just basically these sort of ice mage women, well, ice witches and so on, that exist on Solstheim during in the Blood Moon DLC. And I wonder what their connection is to the Skull. Perhaps maybe they are like in touch with nature kind of thing, but they, I'm pretty sure it's like they're said to be in touch with kine or something like that, or kine witches or something like. But it's like there's another example, because I'm pretty sure from memory that they're even with like frost bears or different sort of animals or wolves or so on, but like really like shamanistic kind of women and so on. And maybe that's another cultural split, perhaps, because in the game they kind of just function as random enemies, like may as well just be a different type of bandit.
Well, but if you talk about kine, I mean, a lot of what the Skulls stand for would fit with kine quite well.
Yeah, absolutely.
In before kine's the all maker. Maker,
but yeah, well,
nature.
Yeah.
Who breathed them on the world?
Yeah. Well, that's I think that's your fantasy Eskimos. I don't know. Does anyone else have anything to say about them?
No, that's all. I think the Blood Moon prophecy talk would fit better in the, you know, her scene type podcast.
At the end of the day, too, I feel like if you have one really good insight to take away from this is that don't buy into, I don't think, the Anu Padme or maker Padme dichotomy. Sorry,
the label maker adversary.
It's flipped.
Yeah,
it's flipped. All maker being the Padmeic element,
which
I think
isn't
makes
unique
far more
to them
sense.
Either. That, you know, obviously most Padmeic religions, like say the Khajiit, have pretty much the same scenario where Anu and Fatima's roles are reversed as well.
I mean, we could make an interesting video out of that. I can see it already.
Mm.
Just tell them you're wrong about the Allmaker, because they probably are. I mean, who knows? It's just a game theory,
or they simply haven't put that much thought into the Allmaker. Yeah. So you're basically wrong. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you everyone for watching. Social media links are down in the description, as is our Patreon link if you want to help support the podcast. And we all look forward to nerding out with you again next time.